President Trump likes to say this about his tariffs.
We're bringing billions and billions of dollars into our treasury right now.
Not so fast, Mr. President. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 4th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to play that piece of tape one more time just to make sure everybody's got it firmly in their minds.
We're bringing billions and billions of dollars into our treasury right now.
The president has been consistent in his messaging about his tariffs and who is paying them. The Chinese is his answer. That message has also been, as two academic papers out this past weekend demonstrate, wrong. The net losers in the president's trade war to the tune of almost $1.5 billion a month are American consumers. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, some of them are starting to feel it.
About a decade ago, Columbia University economist David Weinstein studied tariffs and found, like the president says,
a large fraction of those tariffs would be borne by foreign producers.
Now he's co-author of one of the new studies, and whoops.
I was really surprised. The data showed that it was Americans that were bearing the cost of the tariffs.
The two new studies find the costs are, in the lingo, passed through to consumers. Weinstein estimates a 1% rise in the prices of manufactured goods. So, what changed? In the past, Chinese sellers agreed to pay the tariffs instead of passing them on to U.S. buyers because they were desperate for American business. Not anymore, says supply chain consultant Rosemary Coates at Blue Silk Consulting.
So now these Chinese companies are actually exporting all over the world, so they can look for customers in other places instead of the U.S.
Which means if you're a shopper, watch the price tags on products hit by tariffs. Solar panels, cars, washing machines. One study found protectionism even gives domestic makers the luxury to charge more. At Don's Appliances in Pittsburgh, partner Nicholas Hillebrand says price hikes for the past year have been crazy.
There's a Maytag, which is one of our best-selling washing machines. Last year, we would sell that machine for $499, and now that exact machine, I'm just pulling it up here, is $599.
All this despite rhetoric that trade war is good for Americans. You know, the spin cycle. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Good and easy to win was the exact quote from the president. Regular listeners of this program will know that I am a student of history, and as such, I'm obliged to note that today is the 30th anniversary of Time Incorporated's acquisition of Warner Communications, and thus the birth of one of the first real media mega conglomerates, Time Warner. That merger begat, 30 years later, the recent AT&T acquisition of Time Warner this past June. And now the organizational chart changes are a-coming. Marketplace's Bree Benishore has that one.
AT&T ate Time Warner, and now it is digesting it.
They're breaking down kind of the siloed approach they've taken previously.
Keith Snyder is with CFRA Research, rearranging various networks, splitting up Turner, recombining with HBO. Analysts expect there to be layoffs coming out of this. We'll probably save money. There was a lot of overlap. But that's not what this is all about.
First and foremost, it's about strategy.
Craig Moffitt is senior analyst at Moffitt Nathanson. AT&T is gargantuan. It wants to use shows to help out its phone business. It wants to use the data it gets from its internet and phone business to help ad sales on TV networks. So AT&T is centralizing and reorganizing.
The question is, can you do that without harming the patient? And the most important patient here is HBO. That's the crown jewel of the Warner Media acquisition.
HBO was successful because it was free to be creative and focus on content.
Is that going to be possible in a world where you're trying to make HBO subservient to a corporate strategy that is trying to maximize things like wireless phone subscriptions? I'm not sure.
Jonathan Chaplin is a managing partner at New Street Research, and he says this is what investors are watching for.
The best leading indicator of whether AT&T is going to create value out of this acquisition or destroy value is what happens with talent.
For AT&T's strategy to succeed, it has to keep all the best content creators and executives who make HBO HBO, because Netflix is hiring. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was lousy, then it was really lousy, then it was just bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Congratulations! You are a brand new member of the Congress of the United States. That's the good news. The bad news is that if you want to remain a member of Congress, you got some work to do, by which I mean you got to make some money, some political money. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the time-honored business model of how that money gets made is changing.
Hello, Congressman Golden's office.
A typical day for a new member of Congress is typically packed. On the day I met with Congressman Jared Golden, he was about to dash off to a committee meeting. The new Democratic representative from Maine also balances guests from his district, staff meetings, hearings on the Hill, and he's expected to squeeze in some fundraising.
I'm sure that everyone is being told, just like I have been, that we should be doing that now. And that's fine.
Golden says at this point, he only spends a few hours a week on the phone with donors, but many of his colleagues put in much more time.
A lot of people face intense pressure to hit certain benchmarks in fundraising, and you got to raise millions of dollars.
And not just for your own campaign, but also for the party. Chara Torres-Spellacy is a law professor at Stetson University who studies political fundraising.
There have been decades and decades of members of Congress losing their lives to dialing for dollars.
This is what's known in Washington as call time. Members can't use their government offices for fundraising, but they can use the offices of political parties, just blocks from the Capitol, to make the calls.
Leaked documents have shown that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have encouraged their freshman members to spend 30 hours per week on call time.
That's 30 hours not spent in hearings, working on legislation, or talking to other constituents. When those documents were published a few years ago, they created a public backlash because the people on those donor lists getting all that one-on-one time with members are not your average voters.
Sort of as a general matter, less than 5% of Americans ever give anything to any politician. And so that active, you know, 1 to 5% that does spend on politics, they get the politician's ear.
And politicians got an earful from the media, their constituents, even late night host John Oliver, who devoted a lengthy segment to call time.
Because it cannot help but affect the way you see the world if you're only calling donors rich enough that their main concerns are estate taxes or which Belgian kimono their cats will wear that day.
Politicians aren't wild about call time either. Several have tried to end the practice and failed. But now, things in the campaign finance world are changing, thanks to the internet. Aaron Hill is executive director of Act Blue, the Democratic online fundraising platform.
During the 2018 election cycle, I think we finally saw grassroots contributions really come to the main stage.
Hill says small dollar donations helped fund most of the successful Democratic House candidates in 2018, and many of those small donors signed up for recurring contributions. ActBlue says of donations made to House campaigns in January,
about 78% of those contributions had originated previously in the election year.
So many members are working on building out that network rather than focusing on call time. New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says she doesn't plan to do it at all. Same for presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren. Republicans are also looking to expand their base of small repeat donors with their own online platform, Patriot Pass. Act Blue's Hill says it's too early to know if this fundraising shift will change life for politicians.
If they don't have to spend their time doing call time, if they don't have to spend their time talking with PACs or lobbyists, can they legislate differently?
And can they raise enough money to keep their seats when the next election rolls around? In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Eli Lilly did something interesting today. The Indianapolis-based pharmaceutical conglomerate said it is going to start selling a generic version of its branded insulin product, Humalog. The generic is going to cost $137 a vial, about half as much as the brand name. It's something of a concession to lawmakers who spent part of last week grilling pharmaceutical executives about the high cost of some life-saving prescription drugs. But, and here's the interesting bit, Lilly is going to keep on selling Humalog at its higher price. So we asked Marketplace's Mariel Segarra to explain this two-tiered pricing strategy.
30 million Americans have diabetes. There are only a few companies that make insulin, including Eli Lilly. And the price of its name brand insulin, Humalog, has gone up by more than 600% in 20 years. That's why politicians are saying things like this.
Diabetics who can't afford the cost now self-ration and endanger their lives. But you know what? The investors are happy.
That was Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon last week. Vivian Ho at Rice University says Eli Lilly is offering a generic because it sees the writing on the wall here.
They know there's going to be policy change directed towards lowering drug prices. So they're doing whatever they can to try and counter that and say, look, we actually are giving a fair deal to the consumer.
I mean, we're not tone deaf to the criticism and the pressure, but I'll tell you that we've been working on this for many months.
That's Eli Lilly CEO, David Ricks. He says the company's intention is to make insulin more affordable for people who pay full price, like those who don't have insurance. But why do it this way? Why have a higher-priced name brand drug and a lower-priced generic? It's partly because insurers and other companies that acquire drugs expect to start with the list price, negotiate big discounts, and keep some of that profit. Rick says this is how the system works.
They use those resources to lower the price of premiums for others or to pay for other priorities they have or to profit from it.
He says without those incentives, insurance companies might go elsewhere for their insulin. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If I own my truck, I feel like I'm the boss. So it's kind of hard for you to tell me what to do with my truck because I think I know everything about that truck.
Well, all right. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 206 points today, 0.7%, close to 25,819. The blue chips were off 414 points at one point. That's a lot of points. The NASDAQ dropped 17 points, 0.2%, 75.77. The S&P 500 down 10, about 0.3%, 27.92. AT&T fell back 2.7% today after the company announced it has started reorganizing its Warner Media unit. Office Depot and the Chinese online commerce giant Alibaba are going to create a co-branded online store, Alibaba's first partnership with a major U.S. retailer. Office Depot down 1.9%. Today, Alibaba gained 1.8% in overseas trading. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's an economist in Venezuela named Carlos Hernandez who had a piece in the New York Times a week, maybe 10 days ago, with the headline, "Bitcoin has saved my family." It caught my eye because, first of all, it's interesting that an economist is knowingly using something as speculative as Bitcoin. But also, it says a whole bunch about how bad things have gotten in that country. So we called him up. We got him on Skype. Mr. Hernandez, welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, thank you for having me.
This is going to sound like a silly question, but I want you to tell me how you go about buying a gallon of milk.
Well, first of all, I don't have any bolivars.
No bolivars, which is the currency, right?
Yeah. So what I do, if I wanted to buy milk right now, the first step would be to change my stash of bitcoins to bolivars. I would go to this page where I would exchange it, find a seller that uses my same bank, so the transaction happens immediately.
Yeah.
And then I get the bolivars. And then the other step is finding the milk, which is actually the hard part of the process.
Yeah. Finding the milk is a whole nother thing, and we'll get there. But you do this in bitcoins. You've got a Bitcoin account, and when you need bolivars, because the money changes value so quickly, it devalues so quickly, inflation is so high there, then you instantaneously change the Bitcoin to bolivar and spend the money right away.
Yes, exactly. That's my trick.
Yeah, well, it's a good trick because with the economy down there and with the currency devaluing so quickly, it makes a lot of sense. My question, one of many questions is, you're an economist and you know how risky Bitcoin can be. But the point is, Bitcoin is less risky than bolivars?
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, Bitcoin, I can trade with anyone in Venezuela and I can make the transaction online. And it's way, way more liquid that way. I can change it in minutes.
So once you get your Bitcoin into bolivars and you go down the street to the store, what's on the shelves for you to buy?
Not much. It's no longer easy to find some things that have an actual brand.
Hmm.
For example, there is this guy that has a coffee grinder, and he grinds the coffee right in front of you, and he sells you the coffee in little bags.
Yeah.
There's actually someone who's selling milk in recycled bottles of soda. I don't know where does it get it from, but it's there.
Yeah. Can you buy the milk off the back of this guy's truck or the coffee grinder guy? Can you pay them in Bitcoin or does it have to be bolivars?
No. Bitcoin is not widespread in that sense.
Yeah.
Because there are technological limitations.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet can get a little spotty. I'm actually surprised that this call hasn't cut out.
So am I.
So I don't think that it will get to a point where you have like everyone goes and buys in Bitcoin. That is not going to happen because people are so poor that they don't have a smartphone.
Yeah. What does the Venezuelan government, either one, take your pick, the one with President Maduro or the one with National Assembly President Guaido, what do they have to say about this?
I'm with Guaido.
All right.
Nicolas Maduro has been acknowledging that this market exists.
Huh.
They've made this webpage where you can send them the Bitcoin and they will send you the bolivars.
Ooh.
They actually made a parallel local Bitcoin.
Wow.
Yeah, but the rate is lower. It's like 20% lower, so they take their cut if you use their system.
Yeah. Also,
and you lose the anonymity.
I was just going to say, do you trust them? Because first of all, you have to trust them, but also they'll know who you are.
I don't trust them at all.
Yeah.
I've created an account with a fake name,
and
I've tried and it didn't work. The system doesn't work like everything the government does. But in theory, it's pretty scary what they're doing because I feel like their next step, once they get their system up and running, would be to try to shut down the other alternatives, like local Bitcoin, so they can make us use their system.
A personal question, if I might, Mr. Hernandez, before I let you go. You're a guy of some means because you know about Bitcoin and you have the wherewithal to do this. You've got an education. Why do you stay in Venezuela?
That is the hardest question. So I've been trying to leave for about a year now.
Hmm.
And every time I want to leave, there comes a new opportunity, a new work that I have to finish. So, okay, let me finish this and then I leave. The thing is, the professional workforce in Venezuela is contracting so much. Everyone is leaving.
Yeah.
So you actually have a lot of opportunities if you don't want to leave.
If you have opportunity if you have an education and you can figure it out, right?
And if you know English.
Yeah.
For example, if you were to interview someone in Venezuela right now and you only knew English, you would reach out to me. And there are several of those.
Well, Mr. Hernandez, thank you for your time, sir.
You too. Thank you.
We started the program with a bit of economic theory and fact-checking, the reality of who is actually paying the price for the president's tariffs. We will end with a bit more theory, this time the idea of economic externalities. And to do that, we have to go to the Texas oil patch, where the fracking boom that has made this country the top crude oil producer on the planet has brought some unintended consequences. From the Marketplace Hub at Houston Public Media, Travis Bubenik explains.
The West Texas Permian Basin is hours away from the state's major cities, but in the Permian, it's still normal to find yourself stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. That's because it takes a lot of trucks to get fossil fuels out of the ground. One Texas A&M study from 2016 estimated that drilling and fracking a single oil or gas well in the Permian can involve almost 1,000 trucks hauling things like drilling equipment and sand. So driving oil field roads can be intense. Jose Narvaez does it for a living.
It gets very scary and very stressful.
Narvaez is a trucker with a YouTube channel where, from the cab of his truck, he documents his daily grind hauling sand.
And it's still dark and the fog was really thick this morning.
Truckers have limits on how many hours they can drive over a certain period of time, so with drivers trying to pack in as much work as they can, Narvaez says the highways get hectic.
People are trying to go around you while, you know, traffic is coming in from the opposite direction. They will take that risk to go around you just to pass you.
This part of Texas led the state in deadly crashes involving commercial vehicles in 2018, according to a local nonprofit called the Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance. The group says deaths from those wrecks more than doubled in 2 years, to about 100 in 2018.
We're seeing a level of activity out here that is absolutely hellacious, and the infrastructure hasn't kept up with that.
James Beecham is the Transportation Alliance's president. Oil and gas companies pay the state billions in taxes every year, and Beecham argues more of that money should go to fixing roads to make them safer. But he also says the industry needs a stronger culture of safety.
There's such a rush to fill trucking positions that we're not focusing on safety training that we used to be able to.
Across the state, in Houston, Don Jeffries fires up a big rig simulator used in a training class he teaches. Out on the school's practice range, Jeffries says routine training is essential. Companies can mandate it, but Jeffries says it's harder when you're dealing with independent drivers.
If I own my truck, I feel like I'm the boss. So it's kind of hard for you to tell me what to do with my truck because I think I know everything about that truck. And I don't think you know too much of anything.
As oil production grows, the highways are likely to get even busier. Multiple oil companies have banded together to address growth and the industry's impacts on things like affordable housing and road safety. The companies have pledged $100 million for this broad effort, but there's no clear plan yet for how the money might be spent. Todd Staples with the trade group Texas Oil and Gas Association says the industry also wants more police on the highways.
We're asking the legislature to support the Department of Public Safety's funding request for additional personnel for long-term enforcement.
Andy says the industry supports tapping the state's more than $12 billion savings account for roads money. Most of those savings come from oil and gas taxes. The state transportation department is putting millions of dollars into highway improvements in the region and has installed roadside billboards warning drivers to be careful around trucks. Texas A&M researcher Cesar Quiroga says companies should think of more creative ways to get trucks off the road, like changing how water used for fracking is moved around.
Can we, for instance, enhance or increase the use of temporary pipelines?
A&M researchers are currently working with the state to explore solutions. They plan to share their findings later this year. In Houston, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Virgin Atlantic eases up just a tad on the sexism in commercial aviation. The airline announced some changes to its personal grooming policies today. Female flight attendants will no longer be required to wear makeup. And because, oh, look, it's 2019, the company's standard issue uniform will include pants instead of making flight attendants request them special. Remember, I said the airline is easing up on the sexism in commercial aviation just a tad. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is off 206 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ down 17 points, that is 0.2%. The S&P 500 off 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.